Psalm 73, a psalm of Asaph. Truly God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled, my steps had nearly slipped. For I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For they had no pangs until death, their bodies are fat and sleek. They are not in trouble as others are, they are not stricken like the rest of mankind. Therefore, pride is their necklace. Violence covers them as a garment. Their eyes swell out through fatness. Their hearts overflow with follies. They scoff and speak with malice. Loftily they threaten oppression. They set their mouths against the heavens, and their tongue struts through the earth. Therefore, his people turn back to them and find no fault in them. And they say, "How can God know? Is there knowledge in the Most High?" Behold, these are the wicked, always at ease. They increase in riches. All in vain have I kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence. For all the day long I have stricken and rebuked every morning. If I had said, "I will speak thus," I would have betrayed the generation of your children. But when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task. Until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I discerned their end. Truly you set them in slippery places. You make them fall to ruin. How they are destroyed in a moment, swept away utterly by terrors. Like a dream when one awakes, O Lord, when you rouse yourself and despise them as phantoms. When my soul was embittered, when I was pricked in heart, I was brutish and ignorant. I was like a beast toward you. Nevertheless, I am continually with you. You hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel. And afterward, you will receive me to glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. For behold, those who are far from you shall perish. You put an end to everyone who is unfaithful to you. But for me it is good to be near God. I have made the Lord God my refuge, that I may tell of all your works. Amen.
From Ecclesiastes 3, verse 16. Ecclesiastes 3, verse 16. We're actually going to read to the end of the end of chapter 5. The reason we're doing that is that this is one sermon. Over the last couple of times we've looked at Ecclesiastes, we looked at chapter 1, verse 12 through to 3:15. And that's the first of four sermons in Ecclesiastes, the way we're looking at this book. And so tonight and next time we're going to look at the second sermon. So we won't follow all of the sermon tonight, but let's read it together. The previous sermon, and usually the pattern is, the first part of the sermon is speaking about life under the sun, vanity, and so it has got a negative tone to it, and the hopelessness and futility of life, and the frustration of life. And then the second part of the sermon focuses on God, some aspect of God. Well, actually, the second sermon we're going to read tonight, it does that twice. It has four sections, if you like. It has a negative section about the futility of life, and then the hope that comes with God. And then next time, we'll see, it also has another passage, which is about futility, and followed by the hope that we find in God. So let's read this whole sermon together from chapter 3, 16 to the end of chapter 5. Moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness, and in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. I said in my heart, with regard to the children of man, that God is testing them, that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. For what happens to the children of man, and what happens to the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and to dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth? So I saw that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? Again I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of the oppressors there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. That's the poor. And I thought the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. Then I saw all toil and all skill in work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and a striving after the wind. Again I saw vanity under the sun. One person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, "For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure?" This is also his vanity and an unhappy business. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow, but woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king, who no longer knew how to take advice. For he went from prison to the throne, though in his own kingdom he had been born poor. I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with that youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was no end of all the people, all of whom he led, yet those who come later, will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and striving after wind. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. To draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they are doing evil. Be not rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God. For God is in heaven, and you are on earth. Therefore let your words be few. For a dream comes with much business, and a fool's voice with many words. When you vow a vow to God, do not delay paying it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Let not your mouth lead you into sin, and do not say before the messenger that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For when dreams increase and words grow many, there is vanity, but God is the one you must fear. We'll end the reading there actually at verse 7, because that's where we're going to finish looking at this evening. It's the first half of this second sermon, and we'll read the second part of chapter 5 next time. And that's what we'll focus on in coming sermons. Well, you remember that this little book of Ecclesiastes, we said, is about a brief life in a fallen world lived before a sovereign God. It's about our brief life lived in a fallen world before a sovereign God. And as we think of that as the purpose, the question that comes to us as human beings, is life worth living? If life is brief, is it worth living? If we live in a fallen world, what's the point? If we're under a sovereign God, what's the point? And so the question that always comes up as we read through Ecclesiastes, is life worth living? Now, we've seen that there's an introduction, the first 11 verses of chapter 1, and there's a conclusion at the end of chapter 12. But the main body, as we said, is structured around four sermons. And we looked at the first sermon over the last two times, chapter 1, verse 12 to chapter 3, verse 15. The first section was that negative one, what life is like under the sun. And the second we saw was how life is lived with God. Remember I said about the underlining exercise? Where you underline under the sun, vanity, in a particular color, and then underline the word God in another color. You'll see how the sermons split very clearly when he's talking about sections that are about living under the sun, living in this life here and now, and living with God in the viewpoint and perspective. You'll see that. And you'll remember in the first sermon we saw that in the first section from chapter 1, 12 to 2, 23, that we saw the preacher looked within himself, having looked around at nature, looking back in history, now looked within himself and his own experience of life, and there was this catalogue of things that he found were just meaningless, futile, fleeting. He looked at wisdom, he looked at pleasure, he looked at the preeminence, he looked at hard work, and he saw there's no purpose here. These are fleeting things. They're all vanity, and they're frustrating. It's like herding cats, or as he says, a striving after wind. That was the first half of the sermon. Life was futile. Life was fleeting. Life was frustrating. And then we saw last time the second half of the first sermon, where the references to God started to appear in great number. And we saw from verse 24 of chapter 2 to 3:15, really the lesson we learned is there is purpose with God. Life is worth living because there is purpose with God. We saw that everything is in God's hands and ordered by him, those last few verses in chapter 2. Then we saw, you know, that famous section, a time for this and a time for that. We saw that everything is part of his plan, of a plan. And then we saw everything is full of purpose. So everything is part of God's plan. Everything is ordered by him. Everything is a purpose. So there is purpose with God. Life is not futile and meaningless. Life has a meaning and worth living. Because if we know God, if we fear God and have a relationship with him and see him throned in heaven and give him his place, there is purpose. We see there's purpose in the plan. And the overall aim is not just that you know in your head there's a purpose with God, it's that you fear God. We saw that in chapter 3, verse 14, didn't we? I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. One commentator says that is the key verse in the whole book. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. If you live by that truth, this commentator says, that will give you meaning for life. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing can be taken away from it. God has done it. Why? So that people fear before him. That's the purpose of this letter. It's wisdom literature. It's that you would fear God. That you would fear him. And so we're going to look at this second sermon this tonight and the next evening whenever I preach. And so we're looking first of all at chapter 3, 16 to 5, 7, those verses that I just read. And as we look at these verses, just think of how they can they help you to discover that life is worth living. We saw in the second part of the last sermon, chapter 2, 24 to 3, 15, that life is worth living because there is purpose with God. Can these verses that we're looking at tonight help us to discern whether life is worth living, that life has meaning? And we're just going to look at it under two headings, vanity, life under the sun, and then the first few verses of chapter 5 tell us about God, about God. So really from chapter 3, 16 through to the end of chapter 4 is all about vanity, all about living under the sun. Remember, living under in this world without reference to God, just living in the horizontal without any reference to looking outside of ourselves and God. And one of the key words we'll see is the word saw. He continually says, I saw, I saw, I saw. You know that when mom and dad says to you something, do you understand this? No. Will you do this? No. Well, you might say, eventually I saw, or I see. You say, I see what you mean. And that's what this idea of I saw means here. It means to see in the sense of understanding. I understand. And so the preacher, this wise man, is looking, observing at the world, and he looks around and he sees what the ESV footnote calls a second catalogue of vanities. He looks around and sees these vanities, these things which seem to be futile, frustrating, meaningless. And let me just highlight them for you and make a few comments as we go through, and then we'll look finally at what the passage says about God. The first thing he sees, notice there in verse 16, "Moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice..." He looks at justice in verses 16 to 22. And he simply is saying to himself, if life seems to be frustrating, but if I could just see that there's justice in this world, surely that would give life meaning. And for many people in our world, they devote themselves to the pursuit of justice, whether it's through courts or whether it's helping the poor in other countries. People are pursuing justice in all kinds of ways, all kinds of sorts of causes for all types of people. And aren't we, as God's people, called to be justice seekers and doers? You know that famous verse in the prophet Micah, chapter 6, verse 8. "He has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justice, and to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God." We are to be justice doers. By the way, if you ever go to protests or you see protests on the news, you'll see these verses quoted, or these words quoted. Have you seen placards which say, "Do justice, love kindness, walk humbly"? It's become a slogan of our world. The only thing is they've left out the last bit, "with your God." You'll see on the news bulletins, you'll see in protests, banners, "Do justice, love mercy, walk humbly." But it's with your God. Unless God is in the picture. Micah is saying the same thing as Ecclesiastes. That's by the side. But look at the preacher's conclusion. He said, if only there could be justice in the world, if we could look at justice. But what does he see? Well, he says, instead of justice and righteousness in the world, there's only wickedness. If you have the King James Version or the New King James Version, you'll see it says, in the place of justice is wickedness, in the place of righteousness is iniquity. It's actually the same word in Hebrew, if we translate it wickedness. So in the place of justice, the wise man just sees wickedness. In the place of righteousness, he just sees wickedness. Isn't that your experience of life? If you look at society, whether it's in your own personal dealings or whether it's in the news media or wherever you get your information, it's not your experience that we don't really see justice. We don't really see righteousness. Perpetrators often aren't caught. Or if they're caught and charged, sometimes the charges are really lenient. We often say that the punishment doesn't fit the crime. I don't know if you watch movies or read books, but often one of the motives, somebody told me once there are only 10 storylines, whether you write a book or movies, I don't know, but there's only 10 storylines, and one of the storylines is there's no justice and the hero goes out and kills everybody and there's justice in the end. Whether it's Clint Eastwood or whether it's somebody, your favorite detective, they go out and get justice. Why? Because we know there's no justice, no righteousness in this world. Just last week, International Court in The Hague brought a ruling down. Do you remember the aircraft, MH17, that was shot down over Ukraine in July 2014? And many Australians, as well as many Dutch and others, were killed in that plane flying from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur. 4 men were on trial, 3 Russians and a Ukrainian who's sympathetic to Russia. One was found not guilty. The other 3 were found guilty. Are they going to be in prison? Are they going to be punished? The ruling was they'd been found guilty in absentia, in their absence. And we come across this all the time in life, don't we? That justice isn't meted out very often. And that's what the preacher sees here. That justice doesn't, search for justice doesn't bring meaning to life because we just don't see justice and righteousness in the life. And so what does he say? Well, he says in verses 16 and 17, we just have to leave justice and judgment to the future. There will be a future judgment. The preacher concludes justice will happen in the future. It won't happen in this world. So let's just leave pursuing justice for now in this world. Let's just get on with our lives and God will sort it out if we believe in God or something will happen in the future and let's just leave it to them. Preacher Derek Tidball tells this story in the book. Let me just read it for you. It's easy to do it. A story about a farmer who challenged God and took on his religious neighbors. He was a farmer and he was surrounded. All his neighbors were church-going people. At the same time, he did all his work on a Sunday just to challenge God and to challenge his neighbor. He got a bumper harvest that year and wrote to the local newspaper saying that he had proved there was no value in Sabbath observance. "I have been conducting an experiment with one of my fields," he said. "I have plowed it on a Sunday. I sowed the seed on a Sunday. I irrigated and tended it on Sunday. I reaped it on a Sunday. And I want to tell you that this is the biggest crop in the whole neighborhood." The editor of the local newspaper simply added a comment, "God does not settle his accounts in October." But is that how we view justice, that we can't get justice now? Well, that's what seems to be saying here in 16:17, that there will be a future aspect to judgment. But the following verses then, 18 following, say, in the present time, God has chosen, or he is testing, to let man see themselves to be mere beasts or animals. In other words, he's saying that he's just leaving men and women to get on with it, and when they look at themselves, they just say, well, we're no better than the beasts. We're no better than the animals. We're going to die in the same way. We're just the same as them. Just as any animal will die, I will die. The same things happen to both. They go to the same place if we believe there's anywhere to go, and really what we're saying is that we'll all just go into the dust, and that's it. When life's over, that's it. No more. Finished. Man and animals, there's no advantage in being a human being, is their conclusion. Does that sound familiar to you? I think it's the attitude of many people here. It's a natural outcome of evolutionary thought. But if you remember back in Romans chapter 1, it says this in verse 18, "For the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men by their unrighteousness. They suppress the truth." God's judgment is here and now, and it's in the fact that people are rejecting God. He goes on, in Paul in Romans 1, doesn't he, later on, he says, God gave them up to the lusts of their hearts. Later, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. And so we actually see judgment here and now. It's not that there's no judgment, it's our society is living under the judgment of God. And so as the wise man here looks at justice, his conclusion in verse 22 is simply, just make the best of your life. There's no justice. There's no justice. Just enjoy your work. Just enjoy your short time in life and make the best of it. That's all you can do. Vanity. The second area he looks at is verses 1 to 3 of chapter 4, and it's the area of oppression. Oppression. "Again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold the tears of the oppressed." One commentator has called Ecclesiastes 4 the crying game, because this world is full of the tears of people for all kinds of reasons. We are very familiar with this idea, aren't we? There's no shortage of illustrations spring to mind when we think of the oppressed. We look at war. We look at torture. We look at climate and those who have got nothing and are at the behest of the powerful and rich. We look at the lack of food. We look at UN peacekeeping forces who can't lift a finger to help. We look at our Australian Prime Minister. Have you seen where he's been all this week? Not him personally, but he's been at ASEAN, Southeast Asian people in Cambodia. I'm not sure if he was in Egypt at the COP27 climate change conference sorting that out, but there have been some representative from Australia. He was also in Indonesia at the APEC meeting. He was also in Indonesia with the G20 people sorting out all the richest countries in the world together. He was at APEC in Thailand, so working with all the countries around the Pacific Rim. Will the oppressed be helped by all this talking? Will those who are oppressed in places that are going to flood or with drought, with lack of food and starvation, will they be helped by all of this? The tears of the oppressed. Why? Because they have no comfort. They have no one to comfort them, it says. On the side of their oppressors, there was power. And there was no one to comfort them. You see, when he looks at the oppressed, what he says is there's no comfort. There's no comfort in this life for an oppressed person, for the starving, for the poor, because of power. Lord Acton, British politician, the end of the 19th century, said, "Power tends to corrupt." You probably know the quote. "Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Great men are almost always bad men." If Solomon was the preacher, I wonder, was he able to reverse the oppression in his kingdom? He was king. He had power. You see, at best in this life, good rulers can just try to minimize corruption and wickedness. And what's the outcome? No comfort. No comfort for the oppressed. The next area, so he's looked at justice, he's looked at the oppression. In verses 4 to 6, he looks at work. We've come across the futility of work before, haven't we, in the previous sermon? Remember in chapter 2, verses 8 to 23, we had the idea of barns. The problem was, who will benefit from all your hard yakka? You know, remember the parable of Jesus, the man building barns, and he had so much, he knocked his barn down, built a bigger barn, and was going to fill it with all his riches and crops. The only problem was, he was going to die that night. We put the problem in chapter 2, 18 following was, there's all this hard work goes on, work, 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 worry, 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 because we don't know who's going to end up benefiting from my goods and my profits. But the problem of work here in chapter 4, verse 4, is not so much the idea of who's going to benefit from my work, but the idea of what is the motivation of my work. And the motivation of work often is envy of one's neighbor. You work hard, why? So you have more than your neighbor. Or you work hard so you have what your neighbor has. And you compete and you're in the rat race, as we talk about. We have that phrase, don't we? Keeping up with the Joneses. Do you know that phrase? I don't know who the Joneses are, but they're our neighbors and we keep up with them. There's this rat race and fighting. But Jesus says to us, for what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and yet forfeit his life? And what is the outcome for all this envy and work? Well, there's two possibilities. He says in verse 5, it can end up on us just being lazy. We can see, well, if I work hard just out of envy, there's no benefit. And so I'll just give up. Maybe I'll depend on my family or friends or government. Just remember in the days of Ecclesiastes, there was no government, no social security net, safety net. So we can either just become lazy and have no money and then eventually we have nothing. Or in verse 6, we can be like a workaholic. No end of working. Usually just for work's sake. Never satisfied, never quite enough. One psychologist has said that next to all of the importance of our biological needs, food and so on, and exercise, he rates that the need for achievement is the greatest need to our biological needs. We want to achieve, and we want to be seen to be achieving, and we want to be outdoing our neighbor. Life is meaningless. Life is meaningless. We end up either starving or dying through anxiety caused by our wealth. And so he's looked at justice and oppression and work, and then from verse 7 to 12, he looks at loneliness. He looks around and he sees loneliness. I don't know if you ever read A Christmas Carol. Scrooge, you ever read Scrooge? The description of him by Charles Dickens. Here was this man, worked every day as long as he could keep going. It was the day before electricity, and he would keep going as long as there was enough light to see the page. And he would expect his secretary or the guy working with him to keep working with him. And he put just one coal on the fire in the middle of winter, just enough to keep them there. And he didn't want to take Christmas Day off. But he was a lonely man. He was an unloved man. He pursued wealth. He became, pursuing wealth makes you into a miser. And in turn, misers withdraw from company of others. Focus solely on accruing wealth, not looking to the needs or cares of others, never asking what's the whole point in life or what's the whole point of my work. And the outcome? Loneliness. Verse 8. It says in verse 8, "And the person who has no other," he's no other, "either son or brother, yet there is no end of all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, 'For whom am I toiling? For whom am I toiling?'" Isolation from other people. He's got no one. And he never asks, who am I working for? And there's this loneliness. Verses 9 to 12 actually stand as a kind of positive note in the midst of all this gloom. There's a bit of encouragement for the weak here, support for the suffering. It says two are better than one because they have a good reward for toil. And then it says at the end, and three, "And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken." I've actually preached on verses 9 to 12 at my niece's wedding, and it's a great picture of marriage, isn't it? That two are better than one, but three is best, where Christ is in the marriage. But we have this idea also, not only in marriage is it good to have a company and not to be on our own, but also in a local church. One of the words used for local church life is fellowship. Fellowship means sharing in common, sharing together in common. And that's why we're together. Yes, we've been saved, but we're not saved as individuals. We're saved into a body. And while we worship God, we also care for one another. We have fellowship. And it's only as we see God and have God and fear God that this idea of not being isolated comes to the fore. And so there's justice. He looks at oppression. He looks at work. He looks at the whole idea of loneliness. And he looks finally at the idea of power or popularity, it might be, in verses 13 to 16. The preacher tells us a story at the end of chapter 4. He tells a story of a poor but wise youth and of an old but foolish king. Now, it's hard to work out all the details in the story. Is the youth and the king the same person? Did he start off as a poor youth in prison and get out of prison and work his way up to be king? Is the youth who appears in verse 15 the same youth, or is there two youths? We don't know all the details, but the main point of the story seems to be that power or popularity is in view here. Being in a position or power of popularity, though, doesn't always come with wisdom. And when to retire, to step down. You know that idea? Just because you have popularity or position or power, it doesn't necessarily come with wisdom. We could use lots of illustrations, politicians, others who don't step down in time. I've heard it argued, I don't know if it's true, that if John Howard stayed on too long to stand in the 2007 election, was that true? Do you think that's true? Was it one election too far for him? We don't know. In the past week, there's been an infamous interview in the soccer world, as we lead up to the World Cup, there's one of the two greatest players of all time, Ronaldo, has just come out and said he doesn't respect his manager, he doesn't respect the team he plays for, it pays him £500,000 a week, he doesn't respect this or that or the other thing, and he wants nothing to do with them, they don't respect him. You know, the problem with Ronaldo is he's 38 and he can't run very fast anymore and doesn't score goals. He hasn't realized he needs to retire, and so he blames everybody else. You see, just because you're powerful or in a position of power doesn't necessarily come with wisdom. And so you don't know when to go. You don't know to go gracefully. You don't know to ride off into the sunset like the movie hero. You don't always get to pick one's time to depart. Retirement, retire, step down. And so people, it says here at the end of chapter 4, people will prefer a young pretender who is wise than a mature, stupid king who is in power. And so all of this idea of justice not being this world, oppression, hard work, loneliness, and the lack of wisdom that comes with the powerful and the popular, that describes the hopelessness of men and women in our world. It describes the hopelessness of the society in which we live. And I just want briefly to point you to the first 7 verses of chapter 5. We do this quickly. In the section we've just looked at, there are only 2 references to God. But both of them were in the context of God's judgment. Judgment in the future, chapter 3, 17, and God's judgment or testing in the present, chapter 3, 18. What is the transition from the previous negative vanity under the sun section we've just looked at into chapter 5, verse 4? Well, it's exemplified by what was read in Psalm 73. In Psalm 73, you saw in verse 1 that the psalmist experiences, truly God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. But if you read from verse 2 right through to 16, you'll see all the problems the psalmist faced as he looked at life. He said, why do the wicked prosper? Why do they do okay? And so on. He goes through a whole list. You can read them. But when did his attitude change? It was in verse 17. Did you pick it up? Let me read verse 16. But when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then I discerned their end. He saw the true end, the true predicament, the true standing of the wicked. It was when he came into the sanctuary of the God, until he came into the temple. And it's not that until we come through those doors into this building. But the whole idea is when we acknowledge God and when we worship God and give God his place, give him his worth, as worship means, that is when we see things as they are. You know that there is meaning to your existence. You know that life is worth living. Why? Because the last sermon we saw, there is purpose with God. And here we see it because there is worship of God. But in these verses 1 to 7, there's also a warning that we need to be careful in the use of our words when we approach God. Verses 1 to 3 say that when you come to worship, it is better to listen than to sacrifice. A key component of Old Testament worship was sacrifice. Just look at how much time is spent in the Old Testament describing sacrifice, how it's to be done, where it's to be done, the sanctuary in the desert, then the temple, and what the priest is to wear and what he's to do and when he's to do it. So much time spent on sacrifice. And while it was so important, it was not the most important element of worship. Do you remember some of the Lord's statements on sacrifice? It says in Hosea 6, verse 6, which Jesus takes up in Matthew 9 and 12, he says, I desire steadfast love or mercy. I desire steadfast love or mercy and not sacrifice. The knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. Love of the heart is preferable to burnt offerings and sacrifice, Mark 12:33. 1 Samuel 15:22. Remember Samuel's words to King Saul when he offered sacrifice when he shouldn't have done? He said, it is better to obey than to sacrifice. I desire mercy. I desire your heart, the love of your heart. I desire obedience rather than sacrifice. And that's what he's saying here in verses 1 to 3. We have to be careful in our words when we come to worship. This is gospel advice. Words express what's in our hearts. Using words reveals the state of our heart and before God, what our hearts truly are. Remember we saw in James, be quick to hear and slow to speak. And in the context of the Lord's Prayer in Matthew 6, the unbeliever uses many words and flowery words and displays their words in public. There needs to be carefulness in dealing with God. And chapter 5, verses 4 to 7, there also needs to be carefulness in our vows, not just in our worship, what we say in worship, but our vows. Vows are voluntary promises. Worship is what is commanded. Vows are voluntary promises. And it says in verses 4 to 7, if you make a promise, make sure you keep it quickly before God. Make sure you keep it quickly before God. And so in this sermon, this is the first part of it that we looked at tonight. What is that we see? We see that the worship of God gives us meaning in life. As we worship Him, we see Him, we bless Him. We see Him for who He is, and we worship Him for what He's done. And so we see the worship of God, and in the previous sermon, that there's purpose with God. This is what gives meaning to our lives. And what's the outcome? Well, last time, didn't we see in chapter, what's the outcome God is looking for? The last time we saw in chapter 3, verse 14, as I said earlier, He is looking that we would fear before Him. First, chapter 3, verse 14, I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before Him. We see God's purposes and plans. Why? So that we might fear Him. And it's the same here in chapter 5, verses 1 to 7. We are to worship God. We are to be careful in the use of our words, in our worships, and in our vows. Why? Look at verse 7. For when dreams increase and words grow many, there is vanity. But God is the one you must fear. There's purpose with God, so fear Him. We are to worship God. Fear Him. Show Him respect. Show God the awe that is due to Him. Fear Him. Acknowledge that He is the source of all things, including wisdom and knowledge. Fear Him shows that we have total dependence on Him, not on ourselves, for justice and for how the poor are treated and for work and so on. Fear shows not only that we have total dependence on Him, but it shows us and leads us towards humility, as you saw this morning, and away from pride. Look at all the fear passages in the Old Testament. And one commentator, Benjamin Shaw, says this, that all the passages about the fearing of the Lord in the Old Testament are the same as in the New Testament, to have faith and belief. To have fear of the Lord is to have faith in our Lord through the Lord Jesus Christ. Such fear of God rests in that God will fulfill all His promises. Such fear acts in obedience of the basis of God's promises. May we be people who see that God's purposes are being worked out in this brief world, this fallen world. And may we fear Him. May we love Him. May we believe Him. And may we obey Him. May we worship God. And in doing that, may we be increasingly able to fear Him and to worship Him and to see His works at work in this world. And may we act in response to Him. Let us pray. Father,